Good afternoon. Today, we have Madhura Dasgupta Sinha. In most cases, people start with their first job when they graduate. But Madhura has found a whole new career after she had already had a wonderful streak in banking. She was part of ANZ Greenlace. Then she headed the consumer division, looking after over 2 million accounts at Standard Chartered. And she set up the HR practices and processes at IDFC. But in March 2020, when the pandemic broke, that's the exact point when she decided she needed to make a difference in women's lives. We'll try and figure out how her motivations work and what has got her into the whole new exercise of making a revolution in employing women. Hi, Madhura. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure having you. And there's so much that I want to talk about. But one of the things that I saw was that you won the Chevening Scholarship back in 2003. So did that have something to do with the way your life worked out and the influences that it had?
Well, great that you're starting with Chevening, because it was a very defining experience in my life. Yeah, we are celebrating 20 years of that wonderful experience. The British Chevening Scholarship Program was being given out to 12 women across India. And they were women from all walks of life. And, what I gained out of that 3 months of living in the UK and also traveling a bit of the parts around there, I realized that, you can actually get friendships for life, if you're thrown into circumstances like that. So some of my friends from my British Chevening Scholarship Program today are pillars that aspire for her. They have been my friends, philosophers, guides across my journey. And it's been absolutely, absolutely wonderful to cherish that wealth of friendships that got created during the Chevening days. Also, notably, I think my thoughts around diversity, my views around women in the workplace changed and molded quite a bit thanks to the experience I had in the British Chevening Scholarship Program, because there was a dissertation that we all needed to do. And okay, I had chosen a topic saying, what prevents women from becoming CEOs? And I got a chance to meet very interesting women across the globe because of that, including a bunch of them in the UK. And that actually sort of defined and, helped me also come to terms with some of the harsh realities that women professionals face as they become more and more senior in the corporate world.
Okay. So how did you start off? What were your early experiences in banking?
So I had a very fairly conventional life. I became an engineer because it was a good thing to become an engineer. And I then did my MBA because it seemed to be a good thing to do. And I joined banking purely because, ANZ Greenlace Bank came to our campus and decided I was a good fit. But I truly, truly enjoyed banking because I think the 25 years that I spent in banking were very rewarding in multiple different ways. It shaped my thinking, it shaped my vision, and it also gave me huge opportunities to build on my leadership skills. So I really enjoyed banking. I really enjoyed banking. And I feel a little sad at times that banking and banking careers often get a bit of a bad press at times. But yeah, frankly, I think it can be one of the most enriching careers, I mean, not financially, but otherwise, one of the most enriching careers that one can have on this planet.
Okay. This thing about relationship banking, you get these calls once in a way, you have people who this thing. So, but what does it involve? How do you manage? Because very clearly, this is a relationship that's built on a business. So when it comes to interacting with people who know very clearly that, yes, their interests are being kept in mind, but how is it that you, what are the kind of things that you have to navigate?
So look, banking is finally all about trust. And, you know, the bank that I started with right out of campus was ANZ Grinlays Bank. And that was actually called the Relationship Bank. And I think so many years ago, 25 years ago, they ran a beautiful program on their relationship managers, a beautiful advertising campaign, actually, where they featured the real relationship managers, you know, who would come forward and their faces. And they were stalwarts because customers would absolutely swear by them. And, you know, what I saw in my early years in banking is, you know, when you are part of a bank, you're a branch manager or you're part of the branch, you're part of a community. So the entire community trusts you and the entire community wants to sort of embrace you and welcome you within them. You're there for a few years, but that does happen. So I used to be in Santa Cruz branch and, you know, we had a lot of celebrity customers from Bollywood and, you know, they would come and have a cup of coffee with me from time to time. I would usually get invited to, you know, all the parties of Bollywood, etc. And I used to read Stardust for professional development. So I needed to know the right things and you know who was seeing who and, you know, who was doing which movies so that I could make intelligent conversation with my clients. But finally, you know, when it all turns out to be the kind of person that you are, because often a lot of those customers and, you know, those clients have become great friends. And they talk to me, you know, when they're taking a life decision. They talk to me when they're wanting to make a, you know, big investment or anything that's coming their way, though I have nothing to do with their professional lives or with their banking lives anymore. But I think banking gives you an immediate access to the community. And it's sort of, in those days at least, I think it used to be a lot more evident. There was a huge amount of respect and love and affection for the banker who was almost part of your life. Okay. I was part of another branch, which was a 24-hour branch in Breach Candy. And, you know, again, I think the most high net worth catchment area in the country. And you were expected to know the dog's birthday as well at that point in time. And that was how deep relationships went.
Okay, but what does a 24-hour branch involve?
So you
why,
never shut.
Why does... Okay, it never shuts. But the it point is... Yeah. Okay, which is what online banking is today. But before it came in, what was the fact that it never shuts is the only, or were there things that customers
so
wanted?
Tell you a story. So there used to be a bunch of customers who would, again, this is, you know, Breach Candy, one of the most premier, you know, expensive locations in the country. So there would be customers who would come in at 11 p.m. because they want to access the lockers. And, you know, they would take out their diamonds and then go to the party. Usually these would be all page three parties with fairly high profile, you know, folks, guests. And then they would come back at 3 a.m. and put their diamonds back. So this was...
Okay, diamond in, party in, and then... Diamond back in place and back to work. Okay.
Yeah, and because we were open at 3 a.m. and therefore, you know, it really, really helped them. So you're right that nowadays also banks never shut because you have it all on your mobile phone. And in those days, we were not as, you know, as tech friendly as we are today. Banking wasn't as digital. But this is something that you cannot do digitally, right? So a 24-hour bank did help. And our customers loved the fact that we never shut. So, you know, you just could not put the shutters down. That's it.
But sometimes aren't these customers extremely demanding as well? I mean, can it get a little...
Breach Candy customers were among, I think, the most demanding that I have ever seen in my life. They were extremely, you know, they knew exactly what they wanted. And the world was out there to give it to them. But I think it was one of the best learning experiences in my life, because later in life, I realized that if I have managed a Breach Candy customer well, and if I've kept them happy, I can keep anybody happy.
That's the gold standard of customer management.
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. Because they were difficult, they were demanding, but you know, when you walked with them, you know, with their on their journey, then they would also become great friends. So I think it also gave me a lot of confidence about my own relationship management skills and how, you know, that can, you know, how perhaps, you know, I was kind of, I think, trusted, and there was, I felt there's a huge responsibility. Yeah. And, you know, I sort of liked being part of, you know, that entire circle of trust, really.
What were the Bollywood customers like? Were they, you know, obviously when you see them without the glamour, without the, you know, where they're asking about the mundane problems as opposed to something else.
No, they were amazing. They were amazing. Okay. And, you know, at that time, we had customers, actors, producers, directors, and a whole lot of them. So we had, you know, one of my really, really favorite clients was Aishwarya Rai's father. And he used to keep coming. Mr. Rai used to keep coming to the branch and having a cup of coffee with me almost every day. And it was like my favorite ritual to start my day. And, you know, he would talk about what Aishwarya was doing in those days, really long back, much before she, you know, got married. Yeah. And, you know, and we had such a wonderful relationship. And that, you know, he would share his challenges at times, and he would share how blessed he felt, you know, as a family, you know, because, you know, Aishwarya's career trajectory was really, really taking off.
Yeah.
And we all felt very, very proud of her. Yeah. She was going to Cannes, in fact, and there was one episode. And, you know, at that time, we used to have traveler's checks. And if you recall, the traveler's checks had to be signed in the presence of a branch official. And, you know, so I was the branch manager, and I was supposed to go to her house, and she was going to Cannes, and I was supposed to go to her house and, you know, hand over the traveler checks because it had to happen in my presence.
Okay.
You know, suddenly I realized that my boss and his boss suddenly got very excited about traveler's checks. And so I was like, okay. And they said, really, you know, can we help you in some way? And, you know, We can go across and do this for you. And, you know, I had never seen this enthusiasm and this excitement for any other customer and any other traveler checks. So, you know, it was indeed a very funny moment. And I said, I think I'll manage. But they were very, very, you know, interested and insistent about being of service to me. No other motivation at all. They just wanted to help me out carry to the customer.
No, and you know, you mentioned that once you can handle, you've handled a Breach Candy customer, you've really, and I think that's true of practically every corporate boardroom, because when you get to that level, you know exactly what you need to do and where you need to intervene, where you need to stay quiet and where you need to, which is, I think, an art that evolves only over time. It doesn't come right in the beginning. It's one of those things that you... Do you think you instinctively had it in you? Or was it an art that you developed over time?
You know, I think naturally I'm a bit of an introvert, but, you know, nobody believes it, unfortunately. Nobody believes it. But I believe it. Okay. And, you know, I think I developed the art of conversation, and like you said, about probably the ability to know when one should speak or when one should not, and when one should just hold one's tongue.
I think
I picked that up a lot through my client interactions, and I always feel that that one cup of coffee that you have, you should have it with a customer. And, you know, I think COVID put paid to some of those very glorious thoughts I had about Aspire for Her clients as well, that I should go and meet them all the time. And obviously Zoom and, you know, these virtual models have become much easier now. But I strongly felt that, you know, being a part of their lives and, you know, being a part of their entire ecosystem, and not necessarily only at a transactional level. You know, I need some work to be done, or I need a checkbook to be picked up, or I need a traveler's checks to be, you know, delivered, etc. Not really only at that level, but at a deeper level in terms of being genuinely interested in their lives. I think that's helped me, and I think I have developed that skill a little bit. So I enjoy it. I enjoy being interested in other people's lives and finding out more about them. And it therefore naturally weaves into probably the conversations that I have with them.
Yeah. No, it's really one of those things. And I think that's the other part, that making friends and being able to have long-standing friends, yes, people with whom you've been through a lot right from the beginning, you know, whether it's college or at a point when none of you had anything there was nothing at stake.
Yeah, there's no agenda.
There was no agenda. Whereas, unfortunately, once it gets into a job, there is an agenda. And no matter how open people are, there is always this little thing that you can't be 100% certain that this is how things will work out. Which is sad, but I guess that's the way of the world. It's not as if it's something that... And the sooner you understand those nuances, the better it gets for you.
Yes. But I also think that even later in life, you can actually make good friends.
Yes,
and especially Aspire for Her has actually given me some absolutely amazing friends.
Right.
And that's only 3 years old, right? So I never thought that at the age of 50, you know, I would make so many deep friendships. And I'm very blessed that that's the way it's turned out.
I think that's a complete flip. But I'll just dwell one little bit, because you said that you approached HR in a completely different way at IDFC. And you focused on the employee. What was the thinking there?
Actually, it was a very interesting conversation that I had when I was joining IDFC. You know, I thought that the role that they would probably offer to me would be something in the consumer banking realm. And suddenly the conversation changed, and you know, the person who was talking to me, and I really think he's one of the best thought leaders in HR today. He said, you know, I want you to start something called employee experience. And I said, look, you know, I have not even done an HR degree, and I've never done an HR role in my life. I have been a consumer banker all my life. And why do you want me to do this? And he said, you know, we're going to be the 89th bank in the country, and we will not be able to attract talent unless we have a very strong talent proposition. And that talent proposition can happen if we treat our employees like our best customers. So, hey, I want somebody like you who's dealt with customers all their lives to come in and set up employee experience at IDFC. So that's how that journey started. And it was a fascinating journey of actually building a bank. Because when I joined IDFC, it was not a bank. It was still an NBFC. And only after about 1.5 years did the bank, you know, take birth. So
great.
That was
in a bank. When you started, IDFC would have had how many employees on board? Would have had roughly about zero. You're part of the founding team. Wow.
Yeah. So I was actually probably the third or fourth person who joined for the bank. So I joined the NBFC. I joined the other entity, because at that time there was no banking entity. But I was the third or fourth person who joined for the bank. So, and then, of course, by the time I left, we had 20,000 employees.
Wow. Okay. Now, this is one thing. It's easy to maintain a relationship when the number of people is small. But as you extend and it goes geographically, it spreads across many regions. What's the key? How do you ensure that this employee first is something that you're able to implement right down the line?
So, you know, we used a model of employee experience and we used a combination of tech and touch. As we grow, it's very difficult to replicate that same warmth and affection and touch-based models, you know, across the employee base. So what we did is we started something like an employee experience relationship manager. And this was something that, you know, we used to do, you know, in banking quite successfully. So the EXRMs, or the employee experience relationship managers, would actually be in charge of a certain set of employees, and they would be the sole point of contact to ensure that the bank's you know, policies, processes, relationships, any needs that they had were sort of met. So when we started, we looked at employee journeys, and we looked at journey mapping very closely. And we actually mapped out 18 employee journeys.
Okay.
You know, at the, we started at the time that any person would start thinking about a new job and how can we be in their inbox, how can we be there in their Instagram feed, how can we be there in their social media at that point in time. That's when a journey actually starts, the employee journey starts. And then it continues into, you know, onboarding and recruitment and all of that. And the journey actually never ends because, yeah, you know, because if you've been a part of an organization and if that organization has worked with you for a part of your professional journey, then, you know, you always remain an alumni. You always remain a part of that organization. A part of it, part of you also gets left behind there. So therefore, we feel that it's a journey with a beginning, but not with an end. And all of those 18 journeys, we actually sat down and we used a lot of tech-based approaches to ensure that across the moments of truth of each of those journeys, we also used a bit of touch. So in a critical moments of truth, like, for example, the day that you join or the day that you get your letter. And we used some very small things like, you know, when the employee was getting welcomed into the organization and when she got the letter, we would also give a bouquet of flowers to the spouse. And, you know, this was something that at that time was very, very unusual. And in many cases, the spouses got their first ever bouquets of flowers, you know, from the bank. So, so they were very, very touched and they said, wow, this is really cool. And they would also ensure that, you know, as a part of the journey, they would also ensure that their wife or their husband definitely goes and joins the bank because they felt very special and they felt very, very welcomed. After a few days, you know, the employee would actually get a Starbucks card, a preloaded Starbucks card. And the, while the flower was meant to win over the family and to welcome the family to the bank, the Starbucks card was meant to win over his colleagues and friends. The thought process being that, you know, he or she would go to Starbucks and take other friends along and, you know, also talk about the wonderful new place that they were joining. And therefore, the friends would also want to apply and come and join.
I think you've touched on something really important here that, you know, the way the employee works with the organization and the experience and her experience after she leaves contributes just as much to how easy it becomes to get people in later. Because all it takes is for someone who's worked somewhere to say, no, I didn't like it very much, to turn people off. Whereas if they say, go ahead, you're going to learn a lot from there, it just becomes progressively easier. And I think Mudra also used to do this, that the spouse, the wife or the husband would get something. And it always did make a difference.
Oh, it's a very small gesture, but it made a huge difference. And we continued this for a few years. And of course, every organization evolves and you know, every organization goes through its own journey. But I think we got a lot of accolades and we got a lot of awards for the kind of, you know, impact that this created. And the fact that employees really looked at it as a very, very warm, welcoming workplace, which truly sort of celebrated merit, which truly celebrated its employees.
Yeah. No, and this is true. The other aspect is really to reflect truly what the organization is. So if it's a serious place, if you project fun in the ad, it normally attracts the wrong people.
Yes.
So, yes. I think it's so important to get the tone right. So some people feel that, no, but I will not get the right person. The whole point is that, like you said, the journeys have to be mapped. And then you have to figure out exactly who fits in and who will deliver. Only then does it really make sense. Yeah.
Yes, yes. The whole journey mapping, journey that we did, which is across all those 18 journeys, that was one of the best learning experiences in my life as well.
Mm, yeah. And I can imagine how, going to 20,000 from zero is really something. So it's not something that a lot of organizations will not have that rate of growth beyond a certain point. So you understand scale. You understand it takes it to that level.
Yes.
So let's say now the part which you're really, which you're wholly invested in.
Yes.
March 2020, I think the whole world was worried about the impending pandemic, and you decide that you want to start a new company. Or you want to get into this?
I didn't know that the pandemic would start right after that. So 8th of March is when we wanted to launch. And I had been thinking about this for a while because I wanted to do something for the women of our country. I was turning 50 years old and I felt I waited long enough. And I was looking at the devastating data and I was very, very upset. And, I was complaining to my mother saying, this is so terrible. And how come India is absolutely at the bottom in terms of women's economic participation? And look at LFPR, look at labor force participation rate for women. It's going down every year. It goes down a bit. And just very unobtrusively, it seems to just slide. We've dug ourselves into some kind of hole. What are we doing? And I was seeing the best and the brightest women around me in India. And then my mother looked at me and said, "What are you doing about it?" And so I said, "All right, I think I should do something about it myself." And, she said, "Yeah, instead of complaining and whining and moaning that things are not happening and, others are not doing this and the government is not doing that and this is, and, the world is not doing anything, what are you doing about it? Do something, get up and do something." So I did. That's it.
So what is the first step? Where did you begin?
So, I was very keen to do something for women becoming financially independent. So I basically wanted to motivate all women in our country to become financially independent. And it actually started with one day when, it just became too much. And I said, I have to do this. And the same day, two things happened. So my friend, a dear friend of mine who used to work before and then left her job after marriage, her dad was unwell and she actually wanted to contribute to his medical expenses. She suddenly realized that she does not have any money that she can call her own. And she gets along very well with her husband. It's not that there's any problem, but she didn't want to ask him for money. And she realized that, I cannot even support my dad in his treatment. And this is such a terrible feeling. And she felt very, very depressed and sad about this. And she said, "My parents have done so much and I cannot give back anything." And the same day, as I was having tea, a friend of a friend of my daughter's comes in and says, "You know what? This person," talking about a third person, "she's gone and left her job today. She was working in Deloitte." So I said, "Why? What happened? Has she got a better job?" And she says, "No, not at all. She's getting into an arranged marriage. And the boy's family has said that the women in our family don't work. So she has resigned." And, I said, "Does she not know that she's going to become my friend, my morning friend, in 20 years' time? Does she not know that this is going to happen to her? So somebody needs to tell her that this is going to happen to you." And that's how I thought of the name Aspire for Her. And that's how I said, "Let's get this started." And that's how I started. So I worked for about, I would say, maybe 1.5 months. I think I started sometime in Jan. And then I started working. And I found somebody who would help me do the website, put together the basic creatives and all of that, do some little bit of social media, etc. And I was actually landing in the US on the 7th of March, because we wanted to spend spring break with my daughter. And so the whole flight, I was actually signing off on things and looking at the designs and looking at the website and all of that. So the whole flight was very productive. And we landed and we thought that there was something wrong. I mean, at that time, the pandemic was a little, I mean, it was there, but we felt that it would go off in a few weeks, right? All of us felt that way. And in the US, everybody at that time was very, very, you know, bindas. They were doing their own thing.
Yeah.
And nobody seemed to feel that there was anything wrong. And we felt that we were, you know, probably being ultra cautious, or we were being a little paranoid. And then suddenly everything escalated in that week. So we launched Aspire for Her on the 8th of March, and I was in Boston, and a bunch of folks here across India and other parts of the world all sort of signed in, logged in, and we said, hey, we're on, and we launched. That's it. And the flight, as I said, most of the stuff got done on the flight. So that's it. That's how we launched. And the first day, I think we had just a few people signed up. A lot of my daughter's friends signed up, and every hour we would see to see how many new people signed up to Aspire for Her. And that's how it started. And, okay, that was the beginning.
Okay. I think you say educate, empower, and employment, education, and entrepreneurship.
We say E cube is equal to MC cubed.
Okay. That's how you see the trillion-dollar opportunity.
That's how we see the trillion-dollar opportunity. So E-Cube is essentially employment, entrepreneurship, or education, which leads to one of these two. So deliberately, I put education third, because education has to lead to either employment or entrepreneurship. And MC, CNC are the critical success factors that we work to change mindsets of women and the ecosystem. Mentors and role models, courses, cohorts, and learning, career previews and resources, and of course, community, which is at the heart of all that we do.
Okay. But someone signs up. Okay. You said you sign up and then we will help you.
Yes.
Or you say that we'll figure out what needs to be done. How did you arrive at a kind of system for evaluating what help each person needed?
So we don't really have a very foolproof system for evaluating what help each person needs. But what we do is we use this model for anyone who comes and becomes part of our community. So usually a person who comes into the community has a need. And in any community, in any relationship, as you know, that there is always a mix of give and take. Usually when they join Aspire for Her, there is something that's in the take bucket that's there in their head. So either they want a job, or they want a mentorship, or they want some insight in a career, or they want some learning opportunities, or they want to do a course, etc. So that's when they usually join. And in our experience, what we've seen is that the give and take sort of progresses along as they go along. And at one point in time, they reach a point to say, hey, I want to give back now. You know, okay, I'm a returning woman. I have come into Aspire for Her. I have done the Amazon course. I have got a fantastic job in Capgemini. I feel very happy that I could actually get back into the workforce after 10 years of break. And now I want to give back. I want to ensure that 10 other women, 20 other women, 100 other women like me also find their way back into the workforce. And I help them with their interview preparation. I help them with their confidence building. I help them with negotiation skills, and I give back and pay it forward. That's been the philosophy of our community all through, that it's a mix of give and take. When you come in, you're probably in the take mode, but as you progress and as you grow within the community, you start giving. And there could be another point in time when you want to get back into the take mode again, but it is a community for a lifetime. And it is just like any other relationship, but we want to be that trusted partner by your side.
So do you fundamentally believe that women helping women has a better chance of success than people who say that, no, we must uplift? There's this whole thing about policy where you say that first, I need women to be. So there was supposed to be, okay, 30% of the seats reserved for women. So that something will happen. But we found how that went, because essentially they became proxies. Then there were other things. So how is it that you're able to figure out what is working and where is the pushback? Because obviously these jobs, there's gender diversity, which is important. But when unemployment is so huge, then there is likely to be conflict. So how do you, what are the things that you look at to help people get over the problem or to understand what is it that they need to do?
So, you know, we have a lot of corporates who actually work with us, right? And, right. You know, we have Amazon, Google, we have Standard Chartered, we have DBS, we have Deutsche Bank, we have JP Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, Adobe, Salesforce, IBM, a whole bunch of organizations. These are really forward-looking organizations of our country. And they do understand that diversity is a very important parameter. DEI is a very important thing for them, diversity, equity, and inclusion, primarily because they all also have ESG mandates. So, okay. So like you said, you know, we should not assume that policy level changes do not achieve anything, because we strongly feel that there are policy pushes and there are policy, you know, nudges that do help organizations look at diversity with a far more, you know, inclusive lens. So these organizations that I mentioned, they belong to, if you realize, they belong to a certain genre of organizations, right? They're MNCs who are operating also in India. They're usually headquartered elsewhere. And, you know, they also have very strict guidelines in terms of their own DEI policies, their own DEI mandates, goals, objectives, etc. So what happens in India is that because India often accounts for a large headcount for them, so therefore their numerator versus denominator, because India becomes a large denominator, they want to also ensure that the India numerator looks good, right?
Yeah.
It's all driven by policy finally at the end of it, right? It is driven by the governance policies, ESG policies, right. And right. At the heart of S in ESG is DEI. So does that help us? Does that? Of course it does. And yeah. therefore we would definitely vote for policy level interventions as well. However, there are two lenses, right? One is the lens of the organization or the corporate world and how they're looking at this space. And the other is the lens from the community perspective. I mentioned two stories and I told you about how the community feels about you know, being financially disempowered, being financially dependent. And, you know, especially after being educated, after seeing the world, or after working for a bit, you know, if they're forced to sort of get out of the workforce, or circumstances have compelled them to get out of the workforce in some way, there is a huge sense of vacuum in the women in the country. What that does, and sometimes it is also linked to their sense of self-worth, and their sense of self-worth actually goes down dramatically because they feel that they are not really contributing. So therefore, what we try to do is through the community model, and that's where the community comes in. A community is actually, you know, the source of all the power and all the energy that we have, because a smile for her cannot be there everywhere, but the community. Yeah. Can be there, and the community
at
can
least,
be this. Yeah. It's a whole concept of women supporting women and paying it forward. I think those have been some of the very brilliant, you know, sort of changes that we have seen happening in front of our eyes, and stories of transformation have really motivated us.
No, and, you know, as in advertising, one of the clients we handled this lady had a wonderful idea. It was about training women on simple things in language and managing households and everything else with SMS messages. It was called Mobile Train.
Right.
And then she ran into, you know, problems that you would not have even thought of. For example, most women didn't have a phone in their name. They were using the husband's phone.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is that they had feature phones which could only hold 10 messages at a time or 15 messages. So how do you figure out which is the message to be sent? So when you break it down, you say, I'll create the content, I'll send out SMSs. They will get to learn, they will implement. And then you run across something which seems unsurmountable because, you know, how do you, you can't then be distributing phones to everyone to try and sort this out. So this, I think some of these things are that they require a level of change. So do you believe in the top down works better than bottom up? Or which way do you think this should be oriented?
So it has to come both ways, Venu, actually. It's impossible to... This is a problem that has eaten into the fabric of our country for the past many years, from 2005 onwards. So that's like 17, 18 years, really. It's been a steady decline. And I have a personal working theory of why it started around 2005, because probably by that time, families were getting more prosperous and the per capita income was actually growing. And women were then being told that you don't really need to work, you know, just sit at home and relax and be the queen of your own house. You don't need to work. And that's the reason why I think it was also a lot of self-selection out of the workforce that was happening. So, you know, so in our mind, I think both the approaches are needed. Like I said, that the policy does help because there could be a lot of hiring managers in these organizations that I also mentioned who do not believe in diversity, who only want to hire people who look like them, who feel that a 6-month maternity leave is a very big burden on the organization. There are many people like that in our country. So the policy helps us put a sort of a, you know, a guardrail around those thought processes. And the policy helps motivate, you know, people to actually do this. Because even if you have a good, you know, diversity quotient in your own team, often these organizations celebrate those teams. And if they don't have, you know, enough women in their team, then they're actually called out. So therefore, for whatever reasons, you know, the hiring managers do take some of those calls to say, yes, I need to have a woman. I need to have a diverse candidate. And again, diversity is not only about women. It is about other formats of diversity also.
Right.
But we, of course, look at gender in a bigger way. So it is policy, but it is also a lot of mindset change. And unfortunately, mindset cannot be touched or felt or smelt.
Yeah, not easily at all. Yeah, that's
not easily at all. Which is why we use the EQ physical to MCQ model to change mindsets. It's done in a slightly indirect way. So that it's not really in your face. And we don't keep telling you, oh, you must go to work. And this is the best thing about it. And, you know, you must study hard and you must get in there. We try to be less preachy. We try to be more real voices, real stories, you know, and touch the heart. Yeah.
Can you give me a couple of stories, Madhura, which one is where you felt you succeeded far more than you expected to, and another one where you felt that, no, it fell very short. So I know that you're trying to bridge two, and I just want to give viewers a sense of where it is, has it succeeded, and where does the work, where it hasn't worked, you know? Do you have...
Great. So I'll probably start with the second one and where... So this is a story of a returning woman and she had a gap of, I think, 12 or 13 years. And, you know, so we had at that time started our community with Amazon Web Services and we were looking at women in cloud. We were looking at women getting certified in cloud, and then finding jobs for them. So the first step was to really, you know, announce this whole cohort, and 1,000 people applied. And only 30 of them got into the first cohort. So it was a very selective process. So these 30 people got in and then they worked incredibly hard because it was a 14-week long program, 7 hours a day. So, okay. And this was all online. So it was a fairly intense program which they did. And then they had to write the examination for cloud certification, which is a formal global examination. They did that and they passed. And then they went through a full placement process. And this person got into a very, very reputed organization, reputed MNC after that. So imagine the her entire journey, right? 13 years of break, then getting selected into the cohort, working very hard, passing the exam, going for all of these interviews, and then getting in. So it's a fairly difficult journey. And everybody did not immediately get in, obviously, to this very prestigious organization. She gets in. And then after a few days, like we are prone to do, we told her, hey, listen, come in and you must tell your story to the community because now you have to pay it forward and you have to talk to them. And she started crying. And we said, look, you've had a really fantastic journey. Why are you sad? What happened? And she said that the day that I got into this organization, my husband has walked out of home.
Wow.
Because he says it's either the job or me.
And
look at me, I've taken an incredible amount of, you know, effort. I've invested and I've gone through so much of pain to get myself trained and retrained and reskilled. And here I want to get back into the workforce and I've managed to do this. And this is what happens. So this is a story where I felt that there is a lot that we need to do to the ecosystem, which is for the men as well. We're clearly not doing enough. I think that's something that left me feeling
it really illustrates both sides of the divide.
Yes.
At one point, having to do so much of work in order to get there. And finally, you're stymied not because you didn't make it, but because someone else is feeling insecure.
Yes.
Which is, you know, that's the saddest part of the entire thing. There was this documentary on Netflix which talked about, you know, students from extremely poor backgrounds who were admitted, and then they had to figure out just one person from that group who had come in and study, and then they had to go back to their families who were living in slums every year, and as they progress in their education, it becomes harder and harder for them. For both the family as well as the person who's been selected, because the conflict is just too much. It gets to a point where it's, you know, very difficult to sort of come to terms with, am I lucky or am I not good enough? And at the other end, they see people who are able to go much further. That sets off another set of conflicts altogether.
Yes.
So I think it's wonderful, Madhura, what you're tackling and what you're trying to do. And I think at some point it gets down to, yes, you have your victories, but there are equally large problems that suddenly loom, especially as you get more and more successful and more invested in making that change.
Yes, yes.
Because these are
It's not an easy problem to solve, and it's got multiple layers, and it's got multiple sort of, you know, it's not an algorithm. It's not an algorithm. That's the issue. That's the issue.
Yeah. The algorithm loses it. It'll handle one process.
Yes.
You mix six different variables. And suddenly, it goes off in all kinds of directions.
Absolutely.
As long as the process is repetitive and you require the same result over time, it's fine.
Yes.
Apparently, even ChatGPT goes off into hallucinations if you ask it to, you know, keep doing the same thing over and over again. You start getting results which are not by any yardstick normal.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So I think it's wonderful as to how.
I can tell you the other story as well. You asked for two stories, right? So I can tell you the other story as well, which sort of always motivates me, inspires me. And this is, you know, a person who is from a small town in Maharashtra called Dhule. Her name is Preeti Kate, and We started the Not Alone community after the brutal second wave of COVID. This was in the month of May 2021, exactly two years ago. And the community started because I was very, very devastated. We lost a classmate. We lost several classmates. But for this particular classmate, we were trying to raise a corpus for the daughter's education. And I called the wife and said, hey, you know, I need to get your account number because I'm creating this WhatsApp message so that everyone can remit the funds to the account. And she said, I don't know if I have a bank account.
Wow.
And these are not people like you and me, okay? And I was absolutely devastated. And I said, this is what's happening to the women of our country. They are often missing out. I mean, they're losing their primary breadwinners without even a chance to say goodbye. And they do not even know whether they have a bank account. Forget whether there are huge credit card debts or whether there are loans hanging on their head or whether the house is in their name or not, or whether, you know, the whole PF thing is in a mess. I mean, you know, we found, anyway, so that's how we started Not Alone, a community meant solely for women who have lost their primary breadwinners to COVID. And that community turned out to be a huge source of inspiration for us. And we went headlong in after this conversation. And I said, we have to do something. And we used the same EQ is equal to MCQ model like we use for all our communities, except that the mentorship piece was very, very, very strong here. It was almost like an anchor. It was not really a mentor. And some of our wonderful mentors, they became anchors. And they helped many of the women, you know, take charge of their lives. Many of them were being thrown out of their homes because the in-laws did not want them anymore. They did not know their legal standing. Many of them didn't know finances. It was a huge mess. They were emotionally devastated, financially insecure. It's the worst ever combination that can happen to anyone.
Yeah.
A lot of them felt like they would end their lives. And this person, Preeti Kate, actually, her husband was very young, in his 30s. She had two young children, aged in-laws and parents, and lived in Thule. And husband died due to COVID. And she had never worked in her life before. So Preeti, you know, almost was at a point when she was giving up on life. And then she came and joined the community, the Not Alone community. And, you know, she went through all the stuff that we were talking about. We had a lot of sessions. We had a lot of stuff on mental health. And then I had a wonderful mentor who was actually leading this whole thing. And then she decided that she would take charge of her life. And she started an abacus class in Thule. So she's an entrepreneur. And she has more than 62 children now who actually do abacus with her. She's winning awards at a state level and at a district level. And she's talking on LinkedIn with the colleagues of her husband, and she is celebrating her victories there. So,
that's a real heartwarming story, Madhura. Because again, I think it's wonderful. Do you think it's down to the individual, or do you think that there are some people who never give up? What does it finally add up?
You know, I think the power of the community lends power to the individual. Okay. So if the individual earlier was feeling very lonely and very alone and very shaken, once they realize that they're not alone and there's an entire community around her, she automatically becomes far stronger and far more powerful. And she discovers that power within herself.
Wonderful. This has been an illuminating conversation in more ways than one, Madhura.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for taking the time. And I think it's been a lovely story because I think you've bridged two entirely different, you know, banking where you're dealing with some of the richest and the most well-to-do people. And then going to a set of people who lack even the basics in some of the... So more power to what you do. I hope that it really, you know, Aspire for Her meets millions of aspirations. And at the end of the day, that's the point of change. And I think that's where you're really focused and working to change.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Venu.
Thank you for being on the show. Okay. Bye-bye. That was Madhura Das Gupta from Aspire for Her, a banker who changed the course of her career to help the less privileged and to work for both diversity and inclusion. Thank you for listening. And we'll be back next week for our 25th episode, where we're flipping the equation. Instead of people looking back on their lives, we are talking of what will happen in the future. And we are talking to three young people who are poised to make a major change in their life. Tune in next week and do subscribe and do let us know what you think of the episodes. Thank you. My First Job, the podcast, is a production from Ideascape Communications. Guest relations, promotions, and creative is managed by Deepa Ravi with occasional support by Venugopal Nair. Archiving and technical help is provided by LPS Jayachandran.